Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, a bona fide legend, there's no other way to say it, from the band Bash and Pop, from the band Perfect, briefly from Guns N' Roses, but of course, from The Replacements, Tommy Stinson is on the show today. This is a good one. It's brief and a little rough around the edges, but kind of perfect. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you would like to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do. You can also find me on Twitter or Instagram at Left4Damian. If you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is by heading over to turnedoutapunk.com and checking out some of the shirts that we have put up there. Huge thank you to Corey and Demented by Designs for helping me put this thing together. Check out some of those shirts and pick one up if you would like to. But really, the best way to support the show is by telling all your friends about it. Just let everyone know that you know that we have this podcast here that we do 2 episodes a week talking to people about punk rock. You can also support the show by subscribing to it and rating it on iTunes. Huge thank you to everyone that does do that. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And also, if you want to support it, you can head over to patreon.com/turnedoutapunk and check out some of the stuff that gets put up over there. Footnotes, video episodes, whatnot, and huge, huge thank you to people that do check that out. And speaking of thank yous, I got to give a huge thank you to my friends over there at Vans and the House of Vans who have been supporting this podcast for, you know, just helping me cover the cost of this thing for a long time now. And it is very much appreciated. House of Vans, of course, will be celebrating a 10th anniversary this year. There's a lot of cool stuff, a plan for it. And I might be involved in some of the festivities. Also, the House of Vans in Chicago is back. The Melvins are going to be playing. Oh my gosh. Spring has sprung. I am so happy to be potentially going back to a House of Vans at some point. I have so much fun at those things. They are, you don't really understand. Like, I always said I loved them and I always knew I loved them, but until they're gone, oh my gosh, you have no idea how much you miss something. And speaking of missing something, the band I play in fucked up. I never thought I'd say this, but I've been missing going on tour. And so we will be going on tour as a band come January. We're going to be playing stuff off David Comes to Life because it's the 10th anniversary of that record. That record's being reissued by Matador. We have Epics in Minutes, our first singles compilation, finally coming out on vinyl on the amazing Get Better Records. And Scotty Karate at Tank Crimes is doing the Year of the Horse double LP. It's 90 minutes long, the song, but I think it's just, it's a double LP, 3 sides, I believe. My gosh, we got a lot of stuff going on in Fucked Up. Check out fuckedup.cc for more information on all of that stuff. Okay, on to today's show. Today on the show, Tommy Stinson is here. That's right. You probably are very familiar with Tommy Stinson, but for those of you who aren't, Tommy is, of course, the bass player in the legendary band The Replacements. He was recruited into the band at the tender age. Well, actually, he was already in the band when, you know, the band kind of came together. But anyway, he was in the band from the age of 11 and a half. And his journey to adulthood is kind of the journey of this band. And a fascinating person who has done so much more than just The Replacements in music, obviously. But his role in The Replacements, his age in The Replacements, is just, it's an unbelievable story. And so when Tristan hit me up and he's like, I got good news for you. Tommy Stinson's going to come on the show. We had to make it happen. So this came together very quickly. We couldn't use Zoom. I had to record it over FaceTime audio. So the audio is not really quite the same as other episodes, but you know, it turns out you'll hear it. You can hear it, you know, a little rough around the edges. As I say, it's like a live bootleg, you know, we like live bootlegs here. We listen to demo tapes and things like that. It's shorter. It's on the shorter side, but oh, it's good. I'm excited for you to hear it. I'm also excited to get my hands on a record that I really legitimately love, which is Sorry Ma Forgot to Take Out the Trash. I, of course, have an original, but it is now coming out as a deluxe box set. It's going to be one LP, three CDs, four CDs of bonus stuff, live recording, demos, all sorts of stuff, an incredible booklet. Rhino is going to be putting this thing out. If you do not have this record, if you've only heard The Replacements' later stuff, you should check out this record. This record is different and obviously in keeping with everything they normally do, but this is a lot closer to the sort of punk hardcore stuff. Anyway, we talk about this on the episode. You're going to hear all this thing kind of getting rehashed. But that's it. Pick up this box set. I don't think I have anything else to say. So sit back. Oh, huge shout out to John Kastner, punk legend John Kastner, for helping make this episode come together. And don't worry, we got stuff in the works, hopefully. Hopefully we'll get a chance to talk to John, you know. But that is it for now. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Tommy Stinson on Turned Out a Punk. Tommy, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Well, as I was just telling you off air, I'm a huge fan. And I think more than that also is you just must have, I find anytime you interview someone that was like a kid in this scene, the recollections, though, you know, further away somehow, are also a lot more pure. So I'm really excited to kind of hear your take on everything. So thank you again for doing this.
You're welcome. What do you got?
Well, I
got
to start this off the way they all start off, which is, Tommy, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
I guess it would have been when The Replacements really started playing together. See, we moved from 36th and Bryant in Minneapolis to 22nd and Bryant, probably after we'd been playing together for maybe a year, and that kind of thing. And so my recollection is that one day Chris Mars brought over Nevermind the Bullocks by the Sex Pistols. And I remember my brother having sort of a, given that one the cold shoulder. I don't think he was so much into that because he was still pretty much into Yes and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then, and I don't remember having much of a feeling for it either, as, you know, I was just sort of indifferent to it. It wasn't really until we moved to 22nd and Bryant, I went to a new school district, and I met this kid, David Roth, who became like my best buddy. And at that point, it all kind of opened up for me in a way, because he had been to England already, had a pair of tartan pants at, you know, as a young age of 13 or 14, something like that. And had already kind of been introduced to it because of his sisters and stuff. So I by hanging out with him, you know, came across things like, you know, Generation X and the Pistols and the Clash and, you know, 999 and all these kinds of things. And some of that stuff Paul liked a lot as well. Like 999, I think, was one of his favorites from back then. But you know, hanging out with him, we got way into it. And then, you know, we're into Clash and all that stuff and all the kind of hits of that era, and quickly jumped to, you know, Circle Jerks and, you know, Bad Brains and all that stuff as it was evolved. And we were already kind of, as kids, I mean, we were already kind of late on the early punk scene stuff, really. But at that time, you know, the hardcore scene was starting to ramp up pretty fast. And that's kind of what we got kind of thrown into in a funny way. You know, we got kind of lumped in with hardcore stuff because we played our songs probably faster than we should have at that point. But that was just the vibe we had. And, you know, it was a genre that we never really fit. You know, we would play shows with like Circle Jerks. We opened up for Black Flag and stuff. And it was definitely not our scene in any way. I mean, you know, one of the bigger complaints was, you know, where are all the girls? you know, that scene had a lot of dudes dancing in a funny particular way that, you know, it was more of a dude fest than, you know, a girl fest, that kind of thing. You know, and again, I mean, that's just a funny anecdote about it, but we really didn't fit the aesthetic either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had our ripped up flannel shirts and jeans and stuff like that. And, you know, there was a little more of a attire that went along with some of the hardcore bands of that era.
Well, that's what I find so amazing about, you know, the Twin Cities scenes, you know, like the first wave stuff, even the second wave stuff is like, it's really hard to pigeonhole. Like, you guys are a lot more melodic on mass, but there's also like Halo Flies and there's Willful Neglect and all these kinds of like bands that are taking this thing that in other places is very uniform, but you guys are all doing it differently. Like even Loud Fast Rules, that one song that I've heard off that comp. It's amazing all the different kind of like manifestations of it that was going on in that area.
Well, the one thing that that I will say about that, and it does play out to be true, I really do believe that, is that Minneapolis was such a diverse community musically to begin with, mm-hmm. at that time. I mean, from Prince to The Time to, you know, Husker Du, there were some art bands, you know, there were the Suburbs that were a dance band, kind of arty dance band, and there were just a lot of different things going on, and we kind of couldn't help but, because we played shows with all these different bands, we couldn't really help but kind of feed off of a little bit of everything. You know, I mean, we weren't just Minneapolis didn't have just a hardcore scene. I mean, there were so many scenes at once. It's really, truly, in my opinion, one of the better music melting pots that we ever had in the States in general. I mean, you go anywhere in the country, New York, or you go to LA at different periods, and it's just, you know, there's a scene that's very specific to this or specific to that. Minneapolis was really pretty fucking diverse back then.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. And it affected all of us. I mean, we, you know, whether we would like a certain band or not, you couldn't help if you were playing a show with them, kind of go, a lot of people seem to like these guys. What's going on here? And, you know, kind of contemplate it and wonder, you know, and it affected you.
Well, I guess going back to that very first wave of bands that were happening, like, you know, obviously you're very young at this point, but like how much awareness was there of bands like the Spooks and the Suburbs and like even the Suicide Commandos, like in general?
Well, by the time we started playing, the Suicide Commandos, I think, were pretty much done. I think they'd already broken up at that point. But by the time we were starting to play clubs and clubs properly. But, you know, we immediately started playing with shows with, like, you know, mixed shows with the Suburbs and all these other bands that already kind of had their, you know, had a good thing going on to some degree, you know?
Yeah.
And we, you know, we got a lot of that going on. We were always playing different kinds of weird things with different, you know, Minneapolis bands.
Well, and you hear about it time and time again that there's almost like that's like that first wave of bands, which tended to be, you know, older and artier. And then there's that second wave, which you guys are, you know, as you say, kind of getting lumped in with. But like ultimately, I guess part of that wave of young people getting into this and kind of taking up this thing. And ultimately that becomes hardcore and becomes something else. But was there resistance from these older wave of bands to you guys as this younger group of people taking it differently?
You know, I don't recall so much of that. I think, you know, for the most part, it was a pretty inviting scene all around. I mean, from what I can remember, I mean, you might get something different out of Paul about that, because he's actually, you know, going to clubs and seeing bands and kind of probably feeling more of it. I only felt what I felt from playing shows when we were doing shows with other bands and feeling the, you know, what was coming out of the audience, what was coming out of the, you know, the clubs that, you know, we were playing and stuff like that. And so my recollection of it is that it was, you know, a pretty welcoming, you know, musical community kind of around, you know, across the board. I mean, of course you had little niches of like, you know, the Husker Du crowd and stuff. I mean, they were pretty much straightforward Husker Du fans, and, you know, they some of them would come over our way, but none of them really per se were like into like the Suburbs and stuff like that. It was a kind of a different thing that way. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I mean, it was pretty well wide open.
One of the sort of great documents I think came to light this last year during the end of the world was the Tulsa Jacks demo finally getting released. which of course you play on with Bob from Husker Du, and Chris from the Suicide Commandos plays on it as well. I just wondered, like, once again, you're like 14 on that thing, I imagine. So what are your recollections of that session? Because it is such like it's such an incredible document of that scene.
You know, I'm going to be real shoot from the hip here. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Really?
Yes. I have no idea what you're talking about. What is this that you're talking about? Explain to me what it is that I have to get my memory jarred.
You know what's so funny? In the back of my mind, I'm like, this must be like, cause I think this is something that I, you know, originally came across just recording this show, doing research. I think actually for when Bob was on the show. And it's a tape called Walter's Vacation that was put out by this band, The Jacks. But I guess it was the lead singer of The Jacks, Walter, went up to Minnesota for a year and recorded this demo tape called Walter's Vacation with a guy named Mitch on drums. And you play on four of the tracks. And then there's another couple of tracks where Bob plays with Chris on them from the Suicide Commandos. But it's like, it's sort of this like, it's awesome. Like, they're an incredible power pop band, but it's this weird document where you have this confluence of these sort of three, you know, classic punk bands, but certainly three of the pillars of the Midwest scene.
Man, I just, it's escaping me, the whole thing. I can't even remember that.
I got to make sure you get a copy of this thing now that it's being reissued, because you got to hear this. It's fantastic.
Who's reissuing it?
Reminder Records did it out of New York on vinyl. And it's like a kind of like a much more complete collection of this band, The Jacks, who did a lot of stuff in Tulsa too. But included on that is this sort of like, for at least my mind, legendary tape.
Huh. Interesting.
It's funny because there's another thing in your discography that I want to ask you about, like another sort of like weird offshoot record that pops up is this Lou Santana Croce. That's probably a terrible pronunciation.
Lou Santa Croce.
Croce. Sorry about that. Impersonating a Musician.
Yeah. What is that?
It's called Impersonating a Musician, the LP that you play on?
Yeah. I mean, he was our roadie and our friend back in the day, way back in the day. But also, you know, a songwriter in his own right, doing his own thing. He always has. He actually made another record just a few years back that was really quite a great record. He was like our main kind of roadie guy for a while.
It's awesome.
We went in and made some. We went in Blackberry Way and did some songs with him.
Yeah, it's a great LP. It's like, you know, obviously crazy obscure, and I finally got a tape copy of it eventually. But it's,
yeah, man, you're going fucking deep on it.
Well, that's
you're pulling out the really extra deep cuts here. you'll have to pardon me if I don't remember much about the deep cuts.
Well, no, believe me, you're not the first to come on here, and I'm afraid with the internet and my sort of like need to dig as deep as possible, there's really no end to the obscurity that I'll come up with. So please,
yeah,
I mean no offense by how nerdy this thing gets.
Okay,
I was going to ask you though, like, was the band originally called Dog Breath, The Impediments, or The Substitutes? Because I've heard so many different variations of it.
Pretty much all the above except The Impediments. I mean, I think it was, we started off as Dog Breath. I think we went as The Impediments. And then the guys got in trouble. I was in the hospital for splitting my armpit open on a picket fence. Oof. So they went and played a gig, at a sober house, got drunk, got thrown out, and changed the name to The Replacements because, they had feared that they would never get a job again, would never get a gig again after that debacle. And so, yeah, that's the, and the other one, I'm not so sure we had in the kitty, but it's very likely.
And what was that kind of early stuff that you guys were playing before you guys met Paul? What kind of sound were you guys going for early on? I know, once again, you're super young.
We were playing fucking, you know, FM radio covers of like anything from Johnny Winter to Yes to, you know, just all the crap of the day.
What was the first concert you went to?
I think the first concert I went to was Yes in the Round.
a lot of people have come on and said that tour was a huge tour. That was a huge jumping on point for people that would wind up in punk, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
What about the first punk show you remember going to? Well, probably playing one, I imagine.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, it's hard to say. The first punk show I went to probably was opening for said punk band. And that probably was like, you know, it could have been, it was probably the Plasmatics.
What a jumping in. The,
if you want to call them a punk band.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, that was probably pretty much it. And then from there, it was like, you know, Circle Jerks, you know, Black Flag, things like that.
Well, you know, I've read it like, you know, there's...
X.
Because I've read it over the years in different places that, you know, with certainly with some of the other guys in the band, there was like almost a resistance to like the hardcore music or, and certainly the punk music at the time being like, yeah, we're not really part of that thing. But you're much younger and I imagine much more kind of like in a peer group age with a lot of these people in these that are younger getting into this stuff.
Well, in a funny way, me and David were totally all about it. And more so, I mean, Paul was already evolving away from that. Jesus, even as we did Stink, he was already starting to kind of evolve mentally away from that, I think, because mm-hmm. you can kind of hear it as you get into Hootenanny and even, you know, especially Let It Be. You can just kind of hear the transformation of that. But really, the whole early part of that, where we were kind of getting pigeonholed in that, I don't think it bode well for any of us in particular way, because we really thought we weren't just a one trick pony kind of thing. I mean, we didn't want to be a one trick pony. And a lot of these bands were just simply just, that's what they do. That's what every song kind of does and kind of sounds like, you know, there's kind of a whole thing to it. We were more, you know, we goofed around with a lot of different things back then.
When you were still in high school, were there like a lot of kids kind of like, it must've been so bizarre. Like, but were there other kids getting into punk at that time around you?
You know, not really. I mean, David and I were kind of standouts in that. You know, some of the older kids like David Perner, you know, David Perner was probably, he was a senior when I was a junior. So him and his crew were kind of more, you know, getting into the Clash and things like that, because David Roth's older sister was a high stepper and some of the games that they played and that they were, you know, part of there. David wasn't really so much of a jock, but I think he did play some sports like hockey, I think maybe possibly, you know, and things like that. But he definitely wasn't, you know, in that jock category per se. But people that were in my and Dave's group, age group and stuff, weren't really into that stuff. It wasn't happening yet for them.
There's a legendary story that you quit school by playing Fuck School. Is that true or is that just a legend?
No, that's just a legend. My mom let me drop out of school because we were starting to tour more in the summer, and when my 10th grade came up, we were starting to make money.
Yeah.
And my mom saw it as well. I'd been getting in so much trouble prior to being in a band, she thought maybe this is a good out for me. And Bobby was there to take care of me and that kind of thing. But I think she more looked at it as an opportunity for me to get out and, you know, make a living. And, you know, here I am fucking 55 years old. And I've done that.
As a parent myself now, like, that takes so much courage of her to do, you know, like
absolutely.
Yeah, because she made obviously the very wisest choice on that one, but to trust your kid enough and to like have enough faith that they're going to figure it out to like be like, you know what, you can carve a different path because it goes against everything we're told.
Yeah, and you know, on another hand, she probably didn't have much of an option.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, I was going to do it no matter what. I'd already sucked at school long enough to know that it wasn't going to change. I wasn't going to suddenly wake up and be smart, you know, academically, that is. And, you know, that's kind of how it rolled out.
Yeah. What was it, though, like at that kind of young age being in, like, it's interesting, like, you know, Steve McDonald from Red Cross was on the show and talked about just how, you know, he got kidnapped by his 20, 7-year-old girlfriend when he was 12 years old. Like, just all these wild stories that happened to him. And then you hear about bands like Old Skull later on and all the kind of fucked up things that would happen to them. Like, what was it like being so young in this scene? Like, was your brother protecting you, or was this sort of just like a very different kind of like environment in the scene you guys were playing in?
You know, we kind of all kind of took care of ourselves to a degree. I mean, and early on in our touring, you know, I didn't drink like they did. Of course, we all did certain kind of drugs or whatever together one way or the other. But for the most part, I wasn't a drinker. So when they got hammered at certain gigs, I would get just irate with them. And really, there was one time that happened where I had called my mom and told her she needed to fly me home. We were in Ohio, I think Dayton. And I just thought they just sucked. And I don't want to suck, you know? And so that happened. My mom didn't end up getting me the ticket. They ended up sobering up and kind of, you know, straightening up their act a little bit. And then as time went on, I ended up joining the party, at a young age. And, you know, there you have it.
Well, it's hard to, you know, it's hard at any age, right? Like, the whole thing is set up to get you to drink. Like, the whole industry is set up to make you as a band drink.
Yeah, you're playing bars, you know, it's right there in front of you. All the people seem to be doing it.
Yeah, they're more willing to give you booze than food a lot of times on your rider because it's cheaper for them.
Easier for them, man.
Going back to that first tour, what was that like? Because it's an interesting period in American music, obviously, because it's I guess the scene that you would help usher in, which I guess could be broadly termed college rock, pre-alternative. But it's also like kind of in the height of the hardcore rules era. Like, so what was that early touring like? Like, who were some of the bands you guys were playing with that stand out to you now?
You know, we did a lot of sort of regional stuff, like Chicago, Milwaukee, Madison. You know, Minneapolis, we'd go sometimes, we'd go a little bit west out to like Iowa City or whatever. But, you know, for the longest time, we just stuck to regional stuff. And then, you know, as we started getting a little more popular after that first record, you know, the Del Fuegos wrote us a note about how they'd love to have us come out there. They'd put us up, you know, and feed us all this stuff. They really want us to come. So we actually booked a little tour to go that way. And Boston was our sort of first home away from home. We got in all the trouble you can imagine on that run, that summer of Sam moment. it was kind of nuts, but they became kind of our first, you know, home away from home friends. And a lot of things kind of changed from there, you know, go to New York City for the first time, things like that.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's interesting too when you look at Boston, because you do have bands like that, like the sort of like amazing sort of melodic rock kind of, you know, I guess thing that's coming out of punk and new wave. But then you also have the same time, you've got like SSD Control, and it's like, it is almost like the capital of hardcore rules at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, sorry, when I look back at all that, every place we played had a different version of kind of the hardcore aesthetic and what, you know, what bands were doing in it and stuff. And certainly it wasn't so stringent, like this is the way this band, this whole scene here is, and this way this scene here is in this state, you know, or this town or whatever. There was always kind of a funny thing about it, about each place that had their thing. And you know, New York City was more of like a rock and roll town than it was like more of a hardcore kind of thing when we played there. I mean, they're still just, you know, getting over the junky heroin scene and evolving into something else from that. But
yeah.
But
it's amazing how regional everything was, like music was in general, like not just obviously punk music, but just in general, like regional identity and what was popular in different cities and whole genres that, you know, like go-go music only exists in DC. Like it's something that's so beautiful about, I guess the way popular music develops.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Totally. And which places it develops. I mean, you got to remember back then you only really had college radio to disseminate any of the music. Mm-hmm. And that was just sort of in its, you know, maybe just coming up in its infancy when we were starting out. The only way you could get that is you had some hip college radio kid that found cool stuff, you know?
Yeah. No, it's amazing how important these, like, unpaid DJs are to the history of music. Like, you know, having people on from, I had on Miles Copeland, and he was talking about the Police being broken on college radio first. And that was the way they got into America.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, probably to an extent, totally.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, what was it like working with Tommy Ramone?
It was interesting. I mean, he had a whole way of doing things that we hadn't done before. That was interesting because, you know, it was our first Warner Brothers record, and he was, you know, came from the Warner Brothers camp to some degree with the Ramones and all that. But it was, you know, it was interesting and kind of odd. I mean, he was mixing everything to headphones, which I thought was weird, and everyone else did as well. But he was way past the punk rock scene by then, as far as like probably even what he was listening to on a daily basis.
Yeah,
you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. He was already kind of an older man and stuff, and doing his own thing.
Yeah, his last show in Toronto, he played with his bluegrass ensemble just before he passed away, and it was it was still amazing. But it definitely, you know, it's interesting how, you know, it's a very long life, and people, you know, tend to get associated with very particular parts of their lives, even if it's not reflective of the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Back to making that the case with yourself, I guess going looking at the Saturday Night Live show, that you know, stands out as one of the most memorable performances that's, you know, ever happened on TV for punk music or you know, alternative music, whatever, larger terms. But, you know, it's also, you know, you're one of the few bands that ever got banned, you know, and granted, like, I guess shit got fucked up from what I've heard. But I just think it's so shocking that, like, of all the things, you're still the band, like, that got banned. Like, do you think that's still in effect to this day?
Well, I don't know, because I know Paul's played on there before.
Yeah.
You know, post replacements. But I don't know. You know, I can't really say. Well, the reason we got banned from that, I think, probably had a lot more to do with the fact that we unwittingly let Harry Dean Stanton get drunk in our dressing room, and he was the host. I mean, we didn't know that he didn't have booze on his writer in his dressing room. So when he came down to our room and was being social and asked if he could have some, you know, vodka or whatever, it's like, sure, help yourself, you know. And then he hung out in our room for a while. And then you can see it when the show starts. He's, you know, he's slipping, getting up those stairs, up the ladder to get to where the band is playing so he could play harmonica. We didn't know. We were not involved in what his deal was with that scenario, but apparently that was the deal. They were trying to keep him sober. And, you know, he ended up in our room, and then we end up, you know, screwing off in our own particular way. But I don't think it was just our performance.
Yeah.
Nope. Banned from there.
It's amazing how important that thing was, though, and that performance is, you know, because it was, you know, like a lot of times, short of this college radio stuff we're talking about, this stuff wasn't played on the radio. And like from the B-52's performance to Devo to Fear to yourselves, like this was a lot of people in places that didn't have punk scenes first exposure to this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure enough.
I wanted to ask you, you've mentioned, I think on the Marc Maron interview, like your friendship with Keith Morris. Like, was that going back to those Circle Jerk days?
Yeah. I mean, shoot, we'd play with those guys and, you know, had our ups and downs with them in a particular way over the years. I mean, he would jump on stage with us when we'd play LA and be just kind of hammered back in the day and, you know, just kind of make a mess of things once in a while. But, you know, when I moved to LA, he was sober, and I would run into him all the time, and he'd be, you know, he was a whole different guy then. A whole different guy that had the same aesthetic, really. But it was, you know, it was a funny thing. I've known him forever and, you know, saw him enough in LA that you could call us friends, you know, that kind of thing.
I think Perfect's like a super underrated band. Have you ever thought about doing anything else with it?
Not really, because one of the gentlemen has passed.
Oh, sorry.
Dave Phillips.
Yes.
He passed from cancer last year. And, you know, we did that band. We tried to make that happen. That record almost never came out. And then finally, by the chin of our chinny chin chin, it finally got released. And, you know, it was a moment in time. Mm-hmm. Just kind of like Los Angeles was 20 years moment in my time, of my time, you know.
What about with Bash and Pop when that started getting going? Was that like, was it intentionally something you wanted to do something different than the Replacements? Or like, what was your approach when you formed that?
More my approach was I didn't want to go be a solo artist. I wanted to have a band. Mm-hmm. I liked the band aesthetic more than just like, hey, I'm Tommy Stinson. And that was when I first did that. I really thought I liked the band vibe more than, you know, just hiring some guys or whatever to play whatever I tell them to play. So that's what that was meant to be. It didn't work out so great because of the musicians I had were like the Steve Foley was a great drummer. The guitar player was okay on some things and not great on others. And the bass player, who was the brother of the drummer, was just not really useful to make the record. So it kind of came down to like, okay, this is how we got to do it. And, you know, still wanting it to be the band aesthetic, I kept the band name. Cut to making the last Bash and Pop record, that one actually turned out to be more like what I was setting up to be in the first place, which was it's a band record.
The Clerks soundtrack is something that comes up time and time again. It was actually a big jumping on point for myself. Do you remember how that was put together? Like who approached you about that soundtrack?
For what soundtrack?
Clerks, the film.
Yeah. It was this kid that worked for was it Columbia? Yeah.
Maybe Columbia. Yeah.
What is his, I'm blanking on his name right now. Benji Gordon.
Okay.
He was the one putting together the music for it, and so he we'd see him around, and he thought about putting our song in there, and the guys liked the Replacements and like they're fans or whatever to some degree, so it worked out.
Yeah, it's one of those soundtracks that I think is just. It was wide enough release. It was such a huge movie. It kind of changed cinema, I guess, when it came out. But also that soundtrack was just, once again, like a real eye-opener, I think, to a lot of people that didn't necessarily have access to this stuff.
Right. Well, that's a good point. I mean, it was fun enough for us. We felt, kind of part of it in a way. And what we didn't stick out nearly, as much as we would have in other things.
Did you stamp any of the copies of Stink?
We stamped probably the first 5,000 of them.
Oh, wow.
hand stamped. Might have even been more than that as I think about it. But at least the first 5,000, I think we hand stamped all of us.
Yeah, because I think
and our friends. Yeah,
I think the press runs 10,000 in total, or something like that, which is wild to think of making like a potato stamp to do that with.
Yeah. It was something.
it's funny when you look at the Replacements, it's almost like, do you ever look at it as because what it was, you're growing up through it. Like the band is almost like, can be understood as your coming of age.
Yeah, totally. Well, I mean, that was kind of where we kind of, pushed the hardcore button away.
Yeah.
It was kind of when we started, really when I think when Paul started kind of evolving into another level in a way, because the stuff right after that had a lot more melody to it. It wasn't all fast and furious and all that per se.
It feels like that scene that you guys are kind of coming out of hit that point early on too, where like obviously there are still hardcore bands like Blind Approach and all these stuff that goes on throughout the 80s, but it feels like a lot of the bands like Soul Asylums, yourself, like obviously the power's still there, but it became something different there, and I guess the whole country eventually follows.
Yeah.
Well, this has been an incredible thrill, Tommy. And anytime you want to come back on here and talk about any of this stuff, you know you're always welcome.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it, man. You have yourself a swell rest of your day, and we'll be chatting down the road.
Thank you, Tommy, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Tommy will be back at some point in the future for another episode. And Tommy has a brand new solo record coming out next year. So hopefully around that solo record, he comes back on the show and we get to talk a little bit more. Coming up down the line, though, on this show on Friday, my friend, kind of my new boss, because I'm on her label after all, from the incredible Get Better Records, from Here's the Amazing Band, from the amazing band Jenna and the Pups. Jenna Pup will be on the show. It's a fun conversation, and I am very excited for you to hear it. That'll be coming out on Friday, but that is it for today's show. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous peoples matter. We need to protect trans kids. We need to help trans people protect themselves and stop hate and violence towards Asian people and people of different faiths, and just knock out all this fascist bullshit. Because the end of the day, like the stuff I'm talking about here, these aren't political issues. These are just human rights issues. People just want to be free and deserve to live their lives as free as possible. And it sucks that we live in a world where other people will impose, I don't know, their own insecurities, their own hang-ups, their own problems, their own issues on other people and make their lives harder for them, you know? So it should go without saying, in addition to all this, we also support people's rights to choose what to do with their reproductive systems. Because once again, that's not a political issue. That's just a freedom issue. There are political issues. There's lots of political issues to talk about. Stamps, post offices, roads, they're important issues. They are definitely important issues. And I definitely am very much strongly supportive of the post office. Fund that thing better. Let's bring down those postal rates. Speaking of things we could be doing, make your own culture. Start a fanzine, start a podcast, do whatever. You don't even have to put something out in the world. Just draw a picture for yourself. It'll help your mental health to create something, to make something. And also, this scene, this culture runs on people's contributions. So you might be sitting on one of the great contributions. You know, you might be sitting on the next Twin Tone Records. You might put out the next Replacements. You know, who knows? Sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them anymore. You don't. But something that I found I do need is meditation. I found it very beneficial for me. I didn't believe in it. And maybe you're in the same boat that I was in. Try it a couple times and maybe it'll work. Who knows? But that is it. Thank you everyone for listening. Stay safe and I'll see you on the next episode. Oh, remember, check out turnedoutapunk.com for your shirts and patreon.com for your bonus content. If you've got money burning a hole in your pocket, I mean, if you don't, save that stuff. You don't need to spend it here. If you don't have a lot of it, you need to save it, save it. I wish someone had told me that about all these records I'm surrounded by. Okay. See you on the next episode.